Welcome to another lesson in 1 Samuel. This is 1 Samuel chapter 8, and I've entitled it Demanding the King, which is what the elders of Israel and the people demand of Samuel. Well, there were reasons for choosing the king throughout chapter 8, and I thought I'd just touch on those in way of an outline here. One reason is found in verse 1 is because Samuel is old. There needs to be some sort of succession, someone to follow him. Furthermore, those that Samuel had chosen to succeed him, apparently, were his sons who were dishonest and sought personal gain as judges. Another group, Israel's elders, looked for a king like the nations. They were seeking the status of having a king and the glory. Furthermore, we find in verse 10 through 18, words about what a king would mean for the people of Israel. So God's view. Furthermore, we find that there's an additional motive of the people for having a king, and it was national security in verse 19 through 21. So let's take a look at some of this. Appointing judges, old age, and perverting justice, verses 1 through 3. When Samuel became old, he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second, Abijah. They were judges in Beersheba. Yet his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after gain. They took bribes and perverted justice. Here's a selfie of Samuel when he got old, verse 1. If you follow along in Samuel, find several mentions or several descriptions of what old looks like. Maybe you fit in this category. I'm sure I do some of this. Samuel in chapter 12 says that he has gray hair. I had a little girl ask me how old I was at a park near the church, and I said I was pretty old. And she said I didn't look like that until I took my hat off, and she said, you have old hair, so I can relate. There's also loss of sight with Eli in 1 Samuel chapter 3. There's anxiety waiting for the news of the ark's return in 1 Samuel 4. There's a danger of falling. In fact, Eli falls down and breaks his neck. There's a weight gain in 1 Samuel 4, 12 through 18. Eli is quite heavy. And there's the prospects of retirement, as in 1 Samuel 8, 5, our passage today, as well as Joshua in 1 Chronicles. So a lot to say about old age in the book of Samuel. So they know what old meant, I guess. Well, the first one begins with when. It implies that a long time had passed since the victory of the Philistines in 1 Samuel 7, 12. That was last lesson, the last chapter. By now, says Tusmara, not only has Samuel grown old, but his two sons have been judges long enough so people know their poor quality. Provan suggests a number of decades must have elapsed. Old is mentioned in verse 1 and verse 5, and then again in chapter 12, verse 2. Age 60 seemed to be the point at which people were described as mature or described as aged, according to Leviticus 27. Although Levites retired at age 50, according to Numbers 4, verse 3, 23, and 30. And, well, Samuel eventually admits that he is old and gray, too, in chapter 12, verse 2. We'll find that perhaps the reason he's feeling old may be that his circuit judgeship, if you will, of 50 miles may have gotten really tiring for him. And yet, Samuel's death is not until chapter 25, verse 1, so maybe it's a bit early. Well, let's look at Samuel's judgment of Israel briefly. I think if you look at this slide, you'll notice one word that repeats again and again and again. Samuel had national influence as a prophet to all Israel. Bringing the word of God through Samuel came to all Israel. He calls on the house of Israel to revival we saw in the last lesson, chapter 7, verse 3 and 5. He judges the people of Israel at Mizpah as part of this revival in chapter 7, verse 6. He's the only judge mentioned in the Old Testament who judged all Israel all the days of his life, chapter 7, verse 15. And he gives a farewell address in chapter 12, verse 1, to all Israel. Bergen notes this, 11 times in the Hebrew Bible, Samuel is noted as leading all Israel or at least being influential throughout all Israel. He had national influence. And he had military success. The Philistines were subdued. Cities were restored to Israel. Peace with the Amorites in chapter 7, verse 13 and following. Rather successful judgeship, if you will. But what about the appointing of his sons as judges? Well, the word judge serves strictly within the judicial system. Later, the term of the book of Judges were often political and military leaders as well, and sometimes primarily so. So they started out as part of the judicial system, making decisions in law cases, but later they also include political and military leaders. What was the need for a judge? Well, if we look back to this refrain in Judges chapter 17 and 21, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So to avoid chaos, you needed judges. And 1 Samuel 12:11 sums up important judges this way. And the Lord sent Zerubbabel and Barak and Jephthah and Samuel, and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you lived in safety. Samuel was an important king or important judge. Furthermore, judges were appointed, typically by the community, according to Deuteronomy 16. They would be appointed in their towns according to their tribes, so you had an even distribution of local judges. And they were often raised up by the Lord in the book of Judges, chapter 2, chapter 6, chapter 11, and chapter 13. And later chosen or appointed by kings in 1st and 2nd Chronicles, and still later by order of the king, by Ezra. Well, we have a failed succession plan. What do we mean by that? Well, what Samuel tried to do was a dynasty and not a theocracy, as the judges had been. In fact, in Judges 8, the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hands of Midian. Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. So the people wanted Gideon to establish a dynasty, and Gideon would have nothing of it. And we find in the book of Judges, having sons succeed usually ends pretty badly. Amundsen mentions there are four judges who had sons succeed them. Three of them were unworthy. Only one was useful, Jair. 1 Samuel 12:2 mentions Samuel's sons. This way, the words my sons are with you express not so much the location of Samuel's sons, but rather the idea that his sons belong to the same generation of people as those to whom he speaks, and that the sons are capable of replacing him. It seems that Samuel may have presented his sons, even as late as 1 Samuel 12, as those who could replace him. Well, there were judges in Beersheba. Why Beersheba? Well, Samuel's sons were not under direct supervision by Samuel, for Beersheba lay far to the south, and neither God nor man could blame him for their activities. What is important is that they did not follow his example in verse 3 and 5, and this is important. First of all, they turned aside after game. In the Old Testament, it was the desire of the leaders for personal gain which led Israel into disaster, says Oswald. And we see that referenced in 1 Samuel 8, Isaiah 56, Jeremiah 8, and 22. Secondly, they accepted bribes. In a culture where judges, not juries, rendered a verdict, false accusations, bribery, and influence peddling are the favorite devices of injustice. And you'll find that in Deuteronomy 16 with the law of the king, and then, of course, here in 1 Samuel 8, 3, and beyond. The victims are disproportionately from the poor, among whom are the fatherless, the widow, and the resident alien, Deuteronomy 27:19 and Psalm 82 say. Well, the third point is they perverted or twisted justice. It's the same verb as turned aside. This verse progresses towards a climax. First of all, there's indication towards unjust gain or turning aside. Secondly, or B, there's a taking of bribes, and C, thus perverting justice. Thus, it sums up all three of these points. So why was Samuel not blamed for his son's behavior? Well, unlike Eli, Samuel kept faithful to his God. His two sons were perverting justice. And note that Eli's two sons did not know the law of the priests or the custom of the priests. An example of Samuel keeping faithful and not following his son's example is 1 Samuel 12, 2 and 3. I am old and gray, and behold, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my youth until this day. Here I am. Testify against me before the Lord and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Or whose donkey have I taken? Or whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed, or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind my eyes with it? Testify against me, and I will restore you. Notice I've highlighted the part about a bribe, which is what his sons were best known for. Proverbs 17:23 is a good point here. The wicked accepts a bribe in secret to pervert or twist the ways of justice. Well, let's move on to verse 4 through 9 and the demand for a king like the nations. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, Behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, Give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, Obey the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. According to all the deeds that they have done, from the day I brought them up out of Egypt, even to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are also doing to you. Now then, obey their voice, only you shall solemnly warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them. So, the demand for a king like the nations. What's the reason that's given by the people? Well, Samuel was old, and they didn't like the perverted justice of Samuel's sons, verse 3 and 4. One wonders if the judgment against Eli's house in the earlier part of 1 Samuel 3 and 4 was because of the corrupt sons and the inability of Eli to stop them, a warning about secession. Well, it was anticipated by God. Genesis 17:6, God told Abraham, I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you. Deuteronomy 17 says this, When you come into the land that the Lord your God has given you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations that are around me. God was not surprised by this demand. Well, I think it's useful to make a comparison of the qualifications for a king between the law of the king by Moses in Deuteronomy 17 and the law or the example of the nations or the practice of the nations around them. Well, to begin with, the king was permitted by God when desired by the people. Among many of the nations, kings were a gift of the gods. They had a sort of divine right, if you will. And for the Israelites, a king was chosen by Yahweh, or God. For the nations, the kings were chosen by gods to represent God to the people. For the Israelites, a king had to be a fellow Israelite. Among the nations, oftentimes foreign or illegal usurpers were common. What about some of the limitations or restrictions for kingship? Well, in Deuteronomy, they were not to multiply horses from Egypt. They were not to multiply women in his court. They were not to be greedy with silver and gold. Over for the nations, of course, they were absolute rulers and often gained office through force. And they often had large harems to increase the king's status as well as to make political ties or alliances with other kings. How about the duties to follow? Well, in Deuteronomy, they were to copy the Torah. So the law was received from God. It was not something he created. And the king would have a Torah with him as a guide. And the king was responsible for reading the Torah all the days of his life. He was to be under the authority of the Torah, if you will. If you look at the other side of the tablet here, the nations, the kings discerned the will of gods and carried it out. Well, that's okay, but they did it by divination and other kinds of strange ways of trying to find out the will of the gods. And they made their own laws to protect interests and to favor their friends. Furthermore, they demanded absolute loyalty. There was no question but loyalty was what they were to follow. There was no other authority above them. So you can see the law of the king, there was a great deal of difference between the king of the nations and Israel's king. Well, here's the law of the king, some of the restrictions. Block puts it this way. These three restrictions on common royal behavior addresses the three temptations that many have recognized as common to people in positions of leadership. An increasingly insatiable lust for power, a lust for status, and a lust for wealth. It should be noted that Moses does not hereby prohibit the purchase of horses or marriage or the accumulation of some silver and gold within the country. What was banned was the king's accumulation of all these by exploiting his leadership position for personal gain. Moses highlighted this concern through his threefold repetition of the prepositional expression for himself. Persons are placed in positions of leadership for the sake of those they are called to lead, not for their own sakes. Good application for leaders today, huh? Well, what's Samuel's response to this request for a king? Why was he displeased? Why was he angry? Was it age discrimination? He got tired of hearing how old he was? Criticism of his corrupt sons, perhaps? Rejection of Samuel's ministry? After all, requesting a king to lead is tantamount to a rejection of Samuel's godly leadership and ministry. Nobody would like that. Well, I think it's a demand for a king that displeased, and that seems to fit the context well. And we'll notice one of the reasons is national security in 12:12, but another reason is rejecting the Lord's sovereignty over the people. So why prayer? Well, Henry says that this demand drove Samuel to his knees. He gave them no answer for the present, but took time to consider what they proposed and prayed unto the Lord for direction what to do. Good advice. We're not given the content of the prayer, at least not in the text, but I think Roscoe makes a good guess. The next verse, given God's counsel of what Samuel is to do, suggests the lines along which his prayer must have pleaded. He wanted guidance, and we find that in the answered prayer in verses 7 through 9. What does the Lord tell him? Hear the voice of the people, verse 7. It's a command. It means listen to. Well, literally it means to obey in verse 7, 9, and 22, and all that they say. The idea is that Samuel should do everything that they ask, says Amundsen. And we know that Samuel obeys. And Samuel said to Israel in his farewell speech in chapter 12, Behold, I have obeyed, same word, your voice and all that you have said to me and have made a king over you. But here's the reason for support for obeying this request to hear the voice of the people. Well, they rejected Samuel's leadership, though they allowed him to appoint a king. More importantly, they have rejected the kingship of God, and yet Samuel is to obey them. Well, the rejection of authority, typical of Israel, it didn't surprise the Lord. We find mention of Israel's history of forsaking me and serving other gods in Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Jeremiah, and of course here. There was nothing new in Israelites rejecting Yahweh for other gods, says Payne, but the elders' demand went a step further, rejecting his political arrangements for his own people. Well, the Lord clarifies the assignment in verse 9. Obey their voice in verse 7. Here's another way to translate that. Whatever the people say to you, the New Century Version says. But the Lord gives two restrictions. One, solemnly warn them. It's emphatic, literally, to warn you shall warn them. The other restriction, show them the requirements of a king. This root basically denotes to place a matter high, conspicuous before the person. This was to be a very clear presentation of what the requirements of the king were. The sense is that Israel will not change their mind, so Samuel's goal is to simply forewarn them. If Israel chooses this course, God wanted them to make an informed choice. Well, this desire to conform to the nations around them is something that we also face, don't we? In our clearest and most honest moments, we all too often seek security by conforming to the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times, rather than serving in the world as God's counterculture, as we were created to do. Like Israel, we tend to forfeit the lordship of God in order to become like all the nations. Definitely a temptation for our day. Another point, be careful what you pray for. God knew how to answer the elders by agreeing to their request. God frequently responds this way to rebellion again among his people. When we demand a substitute for God, the Lord will allow us to experience worldly and unbelieving rule with all its harmful consequences. This is not because God was thwarted by the elders' obstinacy or that God found himself at his wit's end. Rather, God intended a humbling lesson that might result in future repentance and restoration. Wow, sometimes God answers the prayers that we should be a little more careful with. Well, let's look at the manner of the requirements of the king in verse 10 through 18. Let me read. So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking for a king from him. He said, These will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his servants. He will take the tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants. He will take your male servants and female servants and the best of your young men and your donkeys and put them to work. He will take the tenth of your flocks and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you that day. Well, what were the heavy costs of the king they demanded? Well, it could be translated customs, their requirements. Chafin says this, none of the advantages and all of the negatives are given, making it a very slanted report. God wants them to know exactly what it is that they are choosing and what the cost will be. It's an amazing, it is definitely a negative presentation. Furthermore, there's key words here, like regulations of the, in the regulations of the kingship, take, I try to emphasize that six times, I think, in verses 11, 13 through 17, and the term best in verse 14 and 16. Youngblood summarizes it this way, by nature, royalty is parasitic rather than giving, and kings are never satisfied with the worst. The sense in each of these six statements is that the king will act without regard for the desires of the people. And yet they still want a king. Well, let's look at the first cost, and that is sons. They will become those who run chariots and cavalry, which was forbidden in Deuteronomy 17. But it was looked on as symbols of the worldly splendor of a king in 2 Samuel and 1 Kings. So it was a status symbol among some. But it was also a very important tool for war. And later on, Jeremiah sees a time when just kings will ride in horse-drawn carriages. So the chariots are coming. Runners, if you see the picture to the right, off to the far right, there's an individual that's running alongside the chariot to protect the, in this case, protect the chariot and the horse from attack by and to go and attack enemy chariots. They're also used as guards at the door of the palace and the treasury. Well, cost to families. Conscription, also known as a draft. Military commanders of thousands. It was a standard military unit. Initially, it was based on tribes, but also a unit of 50 soldiers. There are also common descriptions for organization of military units in Israel. So many were conscripted for that, a large number, it seems, but there are also a large number that are conscripted for plowing and reaping. That is the whole agricultural cycle. Implements of war, they were required to build, or they needed for manufacture. The weapons would include a bow, an arrow, sword, dagger, shield, javelin, all of bronze at this time because the Philistines had a monopoly on iron. Some of the weapons are shown off to the right. Well, not only cost to sons, but also cost to daughters. Some would be conscripted to be perfumers. And Matthew says this, the king's garments were regularly perfumed and spices were burnt in order to maintain a pleasing aroma around the palace. Additionally, some spices are recognized as having medicinal value. Further, daughters would be cooks. A cook is one who slaughters and prepares the meat. And then more daughters would be bakers. Feinberg describes it this way, specifically to the baking of bread and cakes made with flour and oil. Such baked food was a basic element in the daily diet of the Hebrews and their neighbors. Bread was usually baked in an oven, a household duty of women. Bergen sums it up this way, those involved with the general maintenance of a high quality of life for the royal family and officials, most of whom would have been relatives of the king, but for the rest of the people, the hoi polloi, from the ranks of the general population would have come from those who would serve as cooks and bakers, perfumers, and general laborers. Well, the cost to the people. Surprise. More taxes or tithes. Well, the king would take the best of your fields, vineyards, and olive orchards from verse 14. They entail the establishment of a permanent multi-tiered bureaucratic institution utilizing the services of thousands of individuals. To underwrite this form of government, vast quantities of personnel and family resources would have to be given over to the king. And you thought big government was new. Furthermore, the king would give some of his fields, give fields to his servants for loyalty practiced, as exampled by King Saul in chapter 22 of 1 Samuel. And Saul said to his servants who stood by, about him, "Hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of your fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds?" So fields were traded for loyalty by kings. There's a tithe, or a tenth of grain, vineyards, flocks, given to officers and servants. And this was beyond the tenth, or tithe, for the temple and priesthood, given much earlier. Well, another cost to the people, economic assets, male and female servants, young men. The term bahu for young men and its derivative, Behrim, may both be understood to be derivatives of Bahar, to choose, in that the picked or chosen men in a military context are usually the young men. So the best of the young men probably were chosen for military roles. Another economic asset, though we may not think of it as such, were donkeys, thus the cameo over up to the right of the screen. It was used for travel, beasts of burden, threshing, and plowing, so it was very useful in agricultural society that day, and it was considered an economic asset. Slaves, this is the climax of the rights of the king. All the people have, and they themselves are subject to arbitrary use by the king. Solomon did a lot of that. Furthermore, placing this heavy burden on the backs of the citizens of Israel's 12 tribes would have the practical effect of reducing them to slaves, verse 17. Well, let's look at this a little bit more. When Israel experienced slavery before, they cried out to the Lord. It's the same verb, in fact, of the complaining of the people of Israel lamenting their condition as slaves under the Egyptians, Exodus 2:23. Now, to the people of Ekron who suffered because of the presence of the covenant box earlier in this book, 1 Samuel 5:10. So, bottom line, Israel's oppression will come from her king, not from the enemies, as in the time of the judges. Ironic, isn't it? And as the king that whom you have chosen, it implies that it's their own fault. The CEV says, the king that you wanted. A little bit of a dig there. Furthermore, the Lord will not listen. That is, the Lord will remain silent and will take no action when the people cry out, unlike the days of Exodus. Well, the kings, like the nations, cannot redeem. Arnold says this, nothing seems beyond the grasp of the king, whether children, personal property, or one's freedom. Kings take and take, and when everything is gone, they force you to serve. The final indignation, you yourselves will become his slaves, is terminology used of enslavement by a conqueror. The kind of kingship Israel is requesting has no redeeming qualities and is antithetical to Israel's faith and history. And yet they want a king like the nations. Greer says this, quoting Tim Keller, "But every king also says, if you disappoint me, I will make you miserable. Money says that, if you fail to get me and you become poor, you will be miserable. Marriage says, if you fail to get me and you grow old single, life will be terrible. As Tim Keller says, Jesus is the only Lord who, if you receive him, will fulfill you completely, and if you fail him, will forgive you eternally." Let's move on to 19 through 22 and the concern from national security. "But the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel, and they said, 'No, but there shall be a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And when Samuel had heard all the words of the people, he repeated them in the ears of the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, obey their voice and make them a king. Samuel then said to the men of Israel, go, every man to his city. Well, why did the people want a king? Well, no, they refused to listen to Samuel's warning. It's used of Pharaoh's and Israel's refusal to listen to God repeatedly. Even though Samuel had warned them about the cost of a king to society, they give more reasons for wanting a king. They want to be like the other nations in verse 5 and 20, so it's been repeated. Nations as Goyim, you may have heard that term before refer to nations, and in this case it refers to the surrounding nations that exhibit their heathen character by their wickedness, according to Deuteronomy 9, their abominations, Deuteronomy 18 and 2 Chronicles 33:2, and the making of their own gods, 2 Kings 17:29. Furthermore, they wanted a king to judge them. Their desire for a king was really the desire for someone who looked like what they thought a king should look like. I give the example of Saul later on. Rather than of local judges like Samuel's sons. They wanted a figurehead to fight our battles instead of the Lord, as the Lord had done just recently in 1 Samuel 7 and before in Deuteronomy 1:30. Well, how about an application? A teachable heart. Israel then hears God's wisdom but does not submit to it. God gave her instruction, but she is not teachable, which should leave God's current people to cry out for a soft heart, for a teachable spirit, for preservation from the arrogance of our own stupidity. Proverbs 12:15 puts it this way, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice. Well, let's look at them listen to the advice of the Lord. I thought this might be a creative way or easier way to understand what's going on here in verse 20 and 22. They're all listening, but at least in the elders and people case, they're not really listening. So there's a plea from the elders and the people for Samuel to appoint for us a king. And Samuel's response is to pray to the Lord. What's God's response? Obey the voice of the people and all that they say. That's a surprise. He goes on to elaborate in verse 9. God says, obey their voice and warn them. So Samuel, in the middle column, told all the words of the Lord to the people, verse 10 through 18. So it wasn't just a view of a disgruntled prophet who's being replaced or put out to pasture. It is the words of the Lord. So what is the response of the elders of the people? They refuse to obey or to listen to, same idea, the voice of Samuel. So what does Samuel do? He hears all the words of the people. Verse 21. Then he goes and repeats them all the words of the people in the ears of the Lord, verse 21. And what does the Lord do? Obey their voice, he tells Samuel. We find later in chapter 12, verse 1, that in fact Samuel did obey. He says, I have obeyed your voice and all that you have said to me. Wow. Well, obey seems to be the key word here, especially with reference to God's advice to Samuel. So the people demand a king. They refused to obey the voice of Samuel that was given in verse 11 through 18. They demanded a king over them. It's emphatic. I think Roscup gives a good lesson for us. God can do his will even when he lets people get a taste of their own foolish will and learn the backlash of their known better spirit insists on having. Well, sometimes God will let you have your way. Demanding a king is the easy way out, says Arnold, and it places blame on the political system rather than on one's own religious unfaithfulness. How often do we have How often do we blame others or circumstances or other things for our own unfaithfulness? Well, Samuel listens to the people's voice in verse 22. Of course, he's one who prays, so does that again. What is interesting is that he repeats what the people have said. That is, he states emphatically and authoritatively what all that the people said in the ears of the Lord. He makes sure the Lord hears. And Psalm 34:15 reminds us, the eyes of the Lord are towards the righteous and his ears towards their cry. He won't hear the cry of the people later on when they have a king, but he does hear the prophet. He takes our prayers seriously, says Kidner, towards those who are righteous. Well, he not only prays, but he listens and obeys carefully all that the Lord, verse 7 through 9 and 22, and the people say, verse 21 and chapter 12, 1. Furthermore, he not only prays and listens, but he testifies to all the words of the Lord, 10 through 18, rather than just go after them with his anger. Well, Davis reminds us, if Samuel's words never fell to the ground, in chapter 3, verse 19, then surely his word should be heeded as God's word. But Israel will not allow wisdom to lure them away from the folly they so eagerly want to commit. Hence, Samuel is to listen to their voice, verse 22, while they refuse to listen to his. That had to be hard to do on Samuel's part. So God grants the people's demand. The Lord demands of Samuel, obey the voice of the people, 1, 2, 3, 4 times it's mentioned, make them a king. The sense is not that Samuel is to train or educate someone to be a king. Rather, he is to set a king over them, NRSV, or give them a king, the NIV, or appoint them a king to rule over them, NAB. Well, unlike the foreign kings who often ruled over Israel, this would be a king whom God permitted and who would be appointed or anointed and advised by Samuel, God's prophet. So God still had influence over who the king would be. Roscoe says this, God can do his will even when he lets people get a taste of their own foolish will and learn the backlash their no better spirit insists on having. Well, I repeated that quote. It was worthwhile. Well, this is the end of the lesson. First Samuel reminds us of the consequences of rejecting God as our sovereign, of refusing to listen to his word or to hear from him. So thanks for listening. Any questions or comments, please email me at johnston.bob@comcast.net. Lord willing, the next lesson, we'll look at the king that the people wanted in First Samuel chapter 9.